Hello there. Today is Thursday, July 12th. This is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, alliances and friendships are being tested at the meeting of world leaders.
Well, I have to say, I think it's very sad when Germany makes a massive oil and gas deal with Russia.
The U.S. government misses a deadline to reunite the youngest migrants separated from their parents. Chinese companies are caught using a banned ozone-damaging chemical. Also ahead, the World Cup final teams are set. It's all on today's International Edition. Well, sharp divisions over who should pay for Europe's defense have overshadowed the opening of the NATO summit in Brussels, after President Donald Trump accused European allies of taking advantage of American taxpayers. The U.S. spends about 3.5% of GDP on defense, far higher than other member states. It's predicted that 8 of the 29 members, including the United States, will meet the NATO target of 2% of GDP this year. The U.S. provides 70% of NATO's budget. Trump accused Berlin of being under the control of Moscow, citing a new pipeline project that will supply Russian gas directly to Germany.
Ultimately, Germany will have almost 70% of their country controlled by Russia with natural gas. So you tell me, is that appropriate? I mean, I've been complaining about this from the time I got in. It should have never been allowed to have happened. But Germany is totally controlled by Russia.
German Chancellor Angela Merkel, speaking through an interpreter, hit back immediately, not only denying Trump's contention, but suggesting that his comfortable upbringing in the U.S. gave him no standing to spout off on the world stage about Germany.
I would just like to say that I experienced, in person, when a part of Germany was controlled by the Soviet Union. I am very happy that today we are united in freedom, and that we can therefore also say that we determine our policies independently and can make independent decisions, and that is good.
After the seemingly tense bilateral meeting with her U.S. counterpart, Merkel underlined her country's commitment to NATO. Joining us now to talk more about how the summit is going is Paris-based reporter Catherine Field. Catherine, how are European leaders reacting so far to the U.S. president's comments?
So far, at least, there actually has been a bit of a relief because it hasn't been the full-fronted anti-NATO bashing that some members of the alliance were fearing. The initial salvo, which President Trump started off at, which was the breakfast meeting right at the start of the summit, this allegation that Germany relies on Russia for 60 to 70% of its energy and that it was controlling Germany, well, that just really, in a way, got everything off on the wrong foot. But once everything calmed down and everyone realized that, no, Germany is not dependent on Russia for 60 to 70% of its energy, and that German Chancellor Angela Merkel stood her ground and said, no, they are not controlled by the Soviet Union. She grew up in a country that was once controlled by the Soviet Union, and she knows the difference. Once that calmed down and the president actually got talking about other issues such as defense spending, everyone felt that they were, in a way, on the same page. There's always been complaints that not enough NATO members are paying the full whack. They're not spending the full 2% of their GDP on defense. We now have a situation where 5 of the 29 members pay that full 2%. That will be 8 by the end of this year. And by that key date, 2024, a majority of members will pay that. So in a lot of ways, a bit of relief. But then when the president came out and said, well, perhaps it should be 4%, that NATO members should be paying, there was a bit of scratching heads because that came really out of nowhere.
The language that President Trump has been using to describe what he calls his unfair burden on the U.S. would make it sound as if they're supposed to be paying the U.S. or like the U.S. is somehow footing a bill for something, when in reality, this is the U.S. wouldn't be gaining any money if all the European Union countries stepped up with their part of the agreement. They would just be increasing their own defense spending. Is that correct?
That is correct. But the major point about it is that, yes, this is what they're meant to be spending. But at the moment, it does help the U.S. that these European countries are stable, that there is economic growth, that there are no threats to its borders for the time being. So you put aside that they're not spending that 2%. America benefits when Europe is at peace, when Europe is producing goods, and when Europe is trading. And that's the point that they've been trying to say to the American president. Look, this is not just a group of countries for which they are a deterrent against any type of enemies, but it's also a group of countries that has a common plan, that are liberal democracies, that are trading partners, and they're the sort of good, honest trading partners that America wants. But by linking trade and defense, a lot of the allies now feel that this perhaps is not a mutual alliance, but rather it's sort of the president turning it into some sort of protection racket by saying, well, he's going to think twice about defending a country that is not paying its full whack for the defense budget.
Did any of the leaders walk away feeling concerned that he's actually trying to blow up the alliance?
For the time being, seems to not realize the importance of NATO is of concern. But flip that on its head, and you've actually got now the situation where allies have been listening to this, and they are concerned. And what the allies have done, and they've really reinforced that at this meeting, is that they are building up NATO within Germany, within Europe itself. So rather than really relying on American troops, they're building up NATO. And in particular, you've got this new NATO Logistics Command in southern Germany, in Ulm. Now, there will be more troops there. They will be on German territory. That is a real sign, if ever there was one, that they're going to build up NATO and make it stronger and less dependent on U.S. forces that are stationed in Europe. They're concerned that President Trump is giving this impression that they're not united, and therefore when it comes to later in the week, when he then goes off and meets the Russian President Vladimir Putin, that he'll be going there having caused disunity and perhaps slightly undermine the role of NATO as a protector of Europe.
I imagine they are concerned about the upcoming meeting between President Trump and Vladimir Putin.
They are very concerned because there are two major issues which are to do with borders within Europe that are really insecure and are a danger, not just to the countries involved, and in that particular instance, it's Ukraine and Georgia, but also what it means for Europe. Everyone in Europe had thought that NATO, the end of the Cold War, meant that these borders were finished, they were secure, that was it. Now, by having an American president who seems to be very friendly towards the Russian president and very distant to the Western ally does make them nervous.
All right. Well, we appreciate your perspective. NATO nations committed in 2014 to spending at least 2% of GDP on defense, but only by 2024. Here are some of the stories we are following at voanews.com. 11 people have been killed in a suicide attack on the Afghan Education Office. The partisan divide deepens over Trump's Supreme Court pick. Pakistan hosts an unusual meeting of regional spy masters, and Twitter is removing suspicious followers. Find expanded coverage of these stories and more at voanews.com and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. Immigrant parents who reveled after joyful reunions with their young children spoke Wednesday of the traumatic impact of being separated from their sons and daughters for months after they were taken from them at the U.S.-Mexico border. The administration has been scrambling to reunify the families after failing to meet the first two deadlines set by a federal judge who ordered thousands of children be given back to their immigrant parents. Scores of children separated from their families were sent to government-contracted shelters or foster care, hundreds of kilometers away from where their parents were detained. Joining us now to discuss where the situation stands is Justin Guest, assistant professor of public policy at George Mason University's Schar School of Policy and Government. He's also the author of The New Minority, White Working Class Politics in an Age of Immigration and Inequality. Justin, thanks for being with us. So how are things going, and is the zero tolerance policy having the impact the administration is hoping for?
Well, on the one hand, I believe that government resources are being spent in order to adhere to the court order to the extent of which the administration wants to do that. But I think what this really underlines is the fact that what we have in front of ourselves, both here in the United States and also in Europe, is not a crisis of migration. The crisis is in governance. There are multiple governments that are simply unable to responsibly manage the flow of people in a managed manner. And this underscores that.
Has the United States ever done anything like this as far as the way we have separated these families and these young children and then having toddlers and even in some cases younger representing themselves in immigration court?
To my knowledge, in an immigration context, I don't think that the United States has ever done this. I think that this is a first. Now, the United States has an unfortunate history of other atrocities related to children and civilians at war and the internment of the Japanese and the enslavement and oppression of its African-American population. But I think that this will go down as another black eye for the United States and its conception of itself as a city on a hill in the course of its history.
The Trump administration seems to be clearly sending a message, as the president has basically said himself, that let this be a lesson. Don't come here illegally. So in that regard, if that's what they were trying to achieve, it seems like maybe they did, because the word is apparently getting out in some of these Central American countries that the U.S. won't take kindly to coming here. My understanding, though, is that many of these people were actually seeking asylum. Isn't that something that is in our law, that is allowed?
Not only is it allowed in our law, it's allowed by international law, laws that we have signed up for. Really what we're talking about here are apples and oranges. These are not voluntary migrants who are coming seeking work opportunities. These are largely involuntary migrants, people who are forced to flee their home countries because of severe violence, natural disasters, extreme poverty, or what have you. Some of them fit the international definition of a refugee, which entitles them to protection by the country where they claim asylum, and that's where the United States has that international obligation to protect them. And some do not. Some do not fit that definition, and that's why their claims need to be processed in a responsible manner by the United States. The United States is simply detaining people while they consider their application, and it's the manner in which they're being detained that really undermines our humanitarian values. Now, the extent to which that this is a deterrent really, I think, is a matter of why people are coming. If someone's coming because they're hoping to sneak in and get better work than they could at home, maybe this will be a deterrent, because these are folks who are voluntarily leaving their home countries and trying to improve their lives. But the flows that the president is currently underscoring with these policies and with these asylum seekers, these are not folks who are going to be easily deterred by inhumane treatment. These are folks that are fleeing inhumane treatment in their own home countries, only to be treated inhumanely in our country.
What do you see happening next as far as trying to reunite these families? Because my understanding is that they've sort of lost track of some people.
I think that the Trump administration has realized that they may have gone a little overboard and that they're violating a number of human rights standards here. Now, while I don't know how fussed they are about that, I do think that they're going to make some efforts to try to right the situation, because the truth is that the American public and its opinion is strongly against them. Very recently, a Washington Post poll just found that 72% of Americans disapproved of this policy, and in many cases were actually very disgusted by it. And so I don't think that the winds of public opinion are behind them, and I think that they know that. But in other ways, though, this is the politics of theater and symbolism. The message is clear that this is a president and an administration that does not take immigration lightly and is willing to go to great lengths to, quote unquote, protect the American people from immigration as if they are an enormous threat.
Yes, the administration certainly does seem to be putting a lot of fear in people's minds about people coming into the country illegally, and mentions quite a bit this MS-13. What percentage of people coming in are those criminals?
I mean, I can't answer that question with any kind of precision, but I think that is broadly conventional wisdom that migrants are largely peaceful people who want to improve their and their families' lives. And there we do have some precise numbers. From that same Washington Post poll, 94% of Americans in a representative sample believe that immigrants are simply trying to find jobs or trying to escape humanitarian disasters. Only 6% of the country really believes the rhetoric that these are criminals and that they're here to rape and pillage the United States. So I think that this is a pretty bankrupt idea. No one really believes it. However, by painting immigrants in this way, it conveys a sense of threat and distrust that really motivates these kinds of policies further. And so it's really up to Americans to actually say to themselves, well, if we really believe that folks are coming for humanitarian and economic reasons, then maybe we shouldn't be that scared of them, because we as Americans can also understand the desire to have humanity and equal treatment and economic prosperity.
All right, Justin Guest, Assistant Professor of Public Policy at George Mason University and author of the book, The New Minority, White Working Class Politics in an Age of Immigration and Inequality. Thanks for being with us. A newly released report from the non-governmental organization, the Environmental Investigation Agency, has uncovered evidence of the illegal production and use of CFC-11 in the polyurethane foam industry in China. The report comes in advance of a meeting of an open-ended group in Vienna, Austria, of the Montreal Protocol meeting this week, where the issue of the rogue CFC-11 emissions is likely to be high on the agenda. Avipsa Mahapatra, climate campaign lead with the Environmental Investigation Agency, joins us now to discuss. So how was all of this uncovered?
I will maybe start with the May 2018 study published in Nature, where scientists found, so before the EIA work, where scientists found that surprisingly and inexplicably, they were seeing that CFC-11, which is a potent ozone-destroying gas and has been banned globally since 2010, was somehow showing up in the atmosphere in significantly higher quantities than expected. The scientists concluded that it must mean that there is some new illegal production of CFC-11 occurring somewhere, and they could narrow it down to East Asia without pinpointing a single country. And as Environmental Investigation Agency, we have been working in the Montreal Protocol, which is the international treaty that deals with refrigerants and that was created to deal with the ozone hole problem. And so we immediately started our investigations into what might be happening, what could explain this. And in a nutshell, what we found was shocking even to us, because we found evidence that of the 21 companies we reached out to and got a response from, 18 companies spread across 10 provinces in China openly claimed that they are using CFC-11 for building insulation purposes, mostly.
And this is an illegal substance?
That is correct. CFC-11, because it harms the ozone layer and it causes ozone depletion, its production and consumption, along with four other CFCs, was written right into the original text of the Montreal Protocol in 1987. So CFCs were officially banned in developed countries in 1996, and in developing countries by 2010. It's not supposed to be there.
Do you just do the investigations and then you turn it over to another body, or how does that work?
That is absolutely correct, yes. So EIA we are a non-governmental organization. We don't represent a company or a country. So we are an independent campaigning organization. We presented our findings to the government of China so they can take enforcement action. And we are also going to present our findings at the Montreal Protocol, which is the international treaty that all 197 parties of the world are signatory to, which is the environmental treaty and the body that deals with ozone-related issues and gases under it.
Similar to the Paris Climate Accord?
Somewhat similar, but even stronger than that, because under the Montreal Protocol, there are specific gases that the global community has agreed to ban, and there has been, over the many years, there are institutions and bodies that have implemented these bans. There's a financial mechanism that is associated with it. There's a non-compliance machinery that is also associated with the Montreal Protocol. Because this was developed back in the 80s, you know, over the decades, all these institutions and mechanisms could be put in place, which the Paris Agreement is now starting to work on.
The violation, it's by China's foam industry, not China's government, correct?
That is correct. That is correct. However, there is what the Chinese government now has to figure out is every single country in the world has to report to the Montreal Protocol what is getting produced and what is getting consumed in their country. They're required to. And all parties to the Montreal Protocol have been reporting near zero new production and consumption since 2006, which is why when the scientists found this in the atmosphere, their immediate question was, well, if all the countries are reporting zero, where is this coming from? And so you're right, the Chinese government is distinct from these individual companies in the country. So what we are asking the Chinese government to do now is to ensure that, you know, not only do they take action against these specific companies that we have identified and their networks, but also to conduct a comprehensive nationwide review of the sector and investigate beyond these identified factories to make sure that there are penalties for using and producing such banned substance that would deter offenses in future.
This, I'm assuming, is an environmental crime. How big of a deal is this?
This is a massive environmental crime, and if illegal CFC-11 use continues unabated in this sector, as we have identified, our calculations tell us that just in the next 5 years, you know, just between, you know, by 2022, for example, we are looking at as much as 700 million tons of carbon dioxide equivalent. So that on an average is equal to the carbon emissions from 16 coal-fired power plants every year.
That's Avipsa Mahapatra, climate campaign lead with the Environmental Investigation Agency. Thank you for being with us. You're listening to International Edition on VOA.
Hello, this is Shaka Sali, host of Straight Talk Africa.
On the next Straight Talk Africa, the upset-filled 2018 FIFA World Cup wraps up on Sunday. All five of the teams from Africa, Nigeria, Egypt, Senegal, Morocco and Tunisia were knocked out in the preliminary rounds. A discussion on the World Cup on Straight Talk Africa.
Tune in Wednesdays at 18:30 UTC right here on VOA Africa.
Hey, sports fans, brighten your day by tuning in to the sunny side of sports Monday through Friday at 16:30 and 18:30 UTC. Join us on Facebook at facebook.com/VOA Sunny and on Twitter at VOA Sunny Sports. Or check out the blog at blogs.voanews.com/sunny. It's the sunny side of sports right here on the Voice of America.
VOA's International Edition continues. Well, now that the 12 boys have been freed from a cave in Thailand, Hollywood is quickly moving in. The AP's Ed Donahue reports.
The co-founder of PureFlix Entertainment believes the story about the boys and their coach is ripe for movie adaptation. Michael Scott is already in Thailand. The producer behind Christian films like God Is Not Dead has begun talking to some of the participants about their life rights. Scott says this would not be a religious film, but an inspirational film. Ripped from headlines, movies have not been setting the world on fire. 2015's The 33, about the 2010 mining disaster in Chile, barely made a blip at the box office. I'm Ed Donahue.
Well, it will be Croatia against France in Sunday's World Cup. AP correspondent Gethin Kulba has that story.
Croatia is headed to its first ever World Cup final after a 2-1 extra time victory over England in the semifinals Wednesday. Mario Mandzukic scored the winner in the 109th minute. Ivan Perisic equalized in the 68th minute for Croatia after Kieran Trippier's 5th minute free kick goal for England. Croatia's previous best finish at the World Cup came in 1998 when they finished third. England was denied its first trip to the finals since winning the cup in 1966. Croatia will face France in the cup final Sunday in Moscow. I'm Gethin Kulba.
Well, meanwhile, from mutton soup to caviar, Russian food is being enjoyed by football fans from all over the world who are in Russia for the World Cup. Details Now, from VOA's Mariama Diallo.
Before the month-long tournament began, Russian cuisine was probably unknown to many football fans. From the beet-based borscht soup to a dish with salted herring, eggs with mayonnaise, to local pelmeni dumplings and Russian potato salad, fans have been able to experience the country's culture through its food.
We've been eating some traditional Russian food, smoked meat and bean soup, lovely. And I've had a mutton stew. You had a...
I had the chicken wings and the smoked bean casserole as well. Great food, great culture.
As for their other friend sitting across the table...
I can't even remember what it was I had. Mutton soup, wasn't it? Mutton and vegetable soup and then a spatchcock. Really good.
At this food festival, one visitor says he was surprised by how some of the dishes reminded him of home.
I tried a dish of meat with potatoes, carrots, and onions, which is a dish very similar to the one we have in Brazil, and which is very traditional here in Kazan. So I felt almost at home.
Lots of laughs at this table of mostly Brazilian fans who were happy to expand their taste buds beyond typical Russian food. Marcelo Magalhaes from Sao Paulo says his group tried a dish in the shape of a boat, Georgian hachapuri, a cheese-filled bread.
It was a pasta which had an egg yolk and a light cheese. It was really tasty, so I ordered another, and another, and another.
Beer was in big demand. This pub manager decided to make his clients special by serving it in a traditional Russian container usually used to heat water for tea.
We have a beer samovar, but inside we put ice, not firewood, and drink cold beer.
As the tournament draws to a close, and whether their team advanced or not, many of the fans are going home with newly acquired tastes and maybe a bottle of Russian vodka. Mariama Diallo, VOA News.
You've been listening to International Edition. That does it for today's show, but you can find us anytime at voanews.com. We thank you for joining us, and thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Greg Burns. I'm Lori London in Washington. Have a great day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The Russian government continues to stifle press freedom and media independence. The U.S., said State Department spokesperson Heather Nauert, condemns the selective targeting of Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty, or RFERL, and Voice of America, or VOA, under Russia's law of foreign agent media outlets. RFERL and VOA remain the only media outlets designated under this law, which exacerbates long-standing restrictions on their distribution in Russia. Moreover, on July 3rd, the State Duma took another step toward approving legislation that would extend the foreign agent designation from media outlets to individual persons taking part in the creation of materials for media outlets. This bill, warned Ms. Nauert, could provide the Russian government a new tool to target independent journalists and bloggers in retaliation for their work. John Lansing, the CEO and director of the Broadcasting Board of Governors, expressed grave concern over the attack on RFERL and VOA. The new Russian law, he said, is clearly a political attack on an influential U.S. institution and an attempt to discredit the accurate, reliable news we provide to Russian audiences every day. Moreover, he said, this law wrongfully stigmatizes our journalists and puts them at risk. The United States again calls on the Russian government to uphold its commitments under the Helsinki Final Act and its obligations under the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights to respect the exercise areas of fundamental freedoms, including freedom of expression, in Russia. The targeted campaign against RFERL and VOA is worrying and unacceptable, declared Mr. Lansing. But it will not deter us from our mission to inform and engage people in Russia and around the world in support of freedom and democracy.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at www.voanews.com/editorials.